Now we have David Grimm, the editor for our online daily news site. He's here to talk about some recent online stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on more particles in the ocean. A few weeks ago, we had a guest on the podcast talking about seemingly omnipresent microplastics, tiny particles of plastics floating in the ocean everywhere, basically. Now a new study has looked at the content of the very top layer of the ocean and found something different. So, Dave, why look at this uppermost layer?
Well, this uppermost layer, Sarah, is called the sea surface microlayer. And nobody's really looked at it before. That was one of the reasons researchers were sort of curious. Usually when scientists look at the sea, they'll just take a big chunk out of the sea. You know, they're not just looking at their very top layer. They're grabbing everything they can. But these scientists suspected that there might be something special going on with this layer, particularly because this layer has very high surface tension, sticky secretions from microbes, and that keeps tiny particles trapped in this layer. And the thought was, well, maybe these are particles that aren't found elsewhere in the ocean.
What is the comparison like between this micro layer at the very top and other parts of the ocean?
Well, what they found is they found that a lot less plastic than they find elsewhere in the ocean, but they found a lot more of compounds called alkalids, which are a binder in paints, also polyester resins, which are also used in paints and fiberglass as well. On average, a liter of water from the microlayer contained about 195 particles. The vast majority were these alkalids and these polyester resins. And this concentration is about 10 to 100 times higher than microplastic particles in water collected by other methods.
Plastics can come from, you know, pollution from the shore, pollution from sea traffic. Where do the researchers think that these chemicals or these substances are coming from?
Well, they think they're coming from small fishing boats that ply these waters. In fact, there's about 17,000 of these boats in the area where the researchers took their samples. What was really interesting is the fragments that they looked at tended to be dark green and dark blue in color, which are typical colors for these boats.
The concern with microplastics in general is that they absorb toxic materials and that these substances can then enter the food chain. Is there a similar concern for these paint fragments and resins?
Well, there's a concern that zooplankton, which are these tiny creatures that live in the ocean, might be eating them, and this might be toxic to them. And zooplankton are actually a really important part of the marine food web. So this is a potential concern. And the next step for the researchers is to look at the metals and the organic chemicals in the paint particles to determine whether they can actually harm marine life.
Next up, we have a story on progress towards a hypoallergenic nut. Peanuts and tree nuts are a big no-no on playgrounds and in school cafeterias these days due to the fear of sometimes severe reactions in allergic kids. At this point, avoiding nuts is the only path to avoiding these reactions. Dave, how common are these types of allergies?
Well, in the U.S. alone, 19 million adults and children have these allergies. So they're actually a pretty serious concern, at least in this country.
What exactly happens when an allergic person comes into contact with a nut?
Well, what happens is their immune system recognizes specific proteins that are found on the surface of the nut, and then an antibody called immunoglobulin E latches on to these proteins and causes a reaction, an allergic reaction. Sometimes this can just be mild itching. Sometimes it can be life-threatening anaphylaxis, which includes things like itchy rash, throat swelling, and low blood pressure.
In this study we're talking about today, the idea is to stop triggering this immune response by tackling these proteins. What do the researchers do to alter the nuts?
Well, they hit the nuts with a potent combination of heat and sodium sulfite. This is a chemical that's often used in food preservation, so it's safe, but it also tends to break down proteins into smaller pieces. And the researchers hope that if they could modify the proteins on the nuts to this extent, that maybe the immunoglobulin E would not recognize them anymore, and then people wouldn't have this allergic reaction.
And the IgE did bind these proteins less, about 50%. But it didn't completely stop. What's the cutoff that would make nuts safe for allergy sufferers?
Well, it turns out even the tiniest amount of IgE binding could potentially cause a severe allergic reaction. So a 50% reduction, as one expert says, is really just not going to cut it. You're going to need 100% reduction. But this is still an important advance because researchers were able to show that they could start to modify these proteins. And even more importantly, what they were using, the heat and sodium sulfite, both of these are safe. So they're not using toxic chemicals to do this. So the hope is that this may be the first step in creating a safe way to modify nuts that make them safe for people with allergies to eat.
Last up, we have a story on some world-saving worms. About 570 million years ago, cells were just getting together and acting cooperatively. And it turns out that these early multicellular organisms had a big impact on the future of the planet. Dave, can you describe the precarious state of life back in the early Cambrian period?
Well, what was really precarious was the level of oxygen. It had to be at just this right balance. Otherwise, animal life couldn't evolve. If you had too little oxygen, obviously all of these nascent animals are going to suffocate. But too much, and you're going to have things like catastrophic fires, which feed on oxygen, and that would torch the primordial land vegetation, which wouldn't be very good for animals either.
In this new study, researchers have come up with a pretty ingenious idea about how this oxygen balance was achieved. What was the role that worms might have played?
Well, their key organism was some worms, maybe some as long as about 40 centimeters, that burrowed and wiggled in the seafloor, in the ground of the sea. And as these worms wriggled and burrowed, they exposed new layers of the seafloor to the ocean's water. Now, what that did was that each batch of new sediment that settles onto the seafloor contains bacteria. These bacteria were exposed to the oxygen in the water. They began storing a chemical called phosphate in their cells. So as the creatures, as these worms, as they churned up more and more sediment layers, you have more and more phosphate building up in the ocean sediments and less in seawater. Now, why is that important? It's important because algae and other photosynthetic life require phosphate to grow. And so if you remove phosphate from the seawater, you reduce their growth, which means less photosynthesis, and that in turn means less oxygen released into the ocean. That's a very complicated process, but what it suggests is that these worms were really important in keeping oxygen levels down. Now, they couldn't get down too low because if the oxygen got too low, the worms would start dying. So you sort of had this feedback loop that allowed the worms to be the mediators of a decent amount of oxygen in the ocean, but not too much and not too little.
Okay, what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, we've got a story about what kind of cosmic dust the Stardust spacecraft brought back to Earth. Also a story about whether whales and dolphins squeal with delight. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we are doing extensive coverage of the Ebola situation that's unfolding, including stories about experimental drugs that are being used to treat Ebola and one scientist's first encounter with the disease. Also a story about why geneticists are decrying a book on race and evolution. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. This segment is part of the Science Podcast. You can hear the whole show on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and the Science website, www.sciencemag.org.